Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
After decades of work, we've been able to expand to full market access for potato exporters into Mexico. Also, in February of this year, I met with Vietnamese government officials as we finalize access for U.S. grapefruit to the Vietnamese market.
Talking about trade success in 2023, Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Ag Affairs, Alexis Taylor.
Last week, Canada approved the U.S. application for legislative recognition in its land use and biodiversity criteria under its Clean Fuel Regulation. This recognition has actually been 6 years in the making when Canada first laid out this requirement and ensures that U.S. biodiesel and ethanol exports to Canada will continue, which will protect a nearly $3 billion U.S. export market. And just this week, actually, the People's Republic of China lifted high-path avian influenza-related import suspensions on seven U.S. states.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Looking to make sure that the policies that come out of EPA are consistent and able to be followed by the farmers and the seed industry.
Andy Levine is president and CEO, American Seed Trade Association.
They've got to have some good, strong policies there. Unfortunately, the last couple of years, we've seen a number of lawsuits that have come at the seed treatment arena, and we've had to work with EPA and with several of our state governments to make sure that the policy around seed treatment is consistent from state to state. So under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, treated seed is included in the act in the treatment of the seed, but once it's treated, it's covered under the federal seed law. And so it's what's called a treated article, and we need to make sure that that treated article provision stays covering seed like it does with other treated materials across the board in commerce today. So it's really technical as we get into it, Tony, but when we look at that, it's just another attempt by some folks that would like to get rid of modern agriculture and the tools the farmers are using today. So we're working really closely with EPA, with our colleagues in CropLife America and in the grower organizations to make sure that EPA understands why we use treated seeds and why farmers have adopted that those tools and technologies.
He talks about how the industry works to get EPA and others actually out in the field.
You know, that we have, and we've seen some opportunities there, both to get them with growers who are using these tools and techniques, as well as to bring them out to see facilities so that they better understand, as they're looking at a registration or potential regulation, how the seed is actually treated with a chemistry or a micronutrient or a biological. And then how clean that process is with respect to that treatment. And it's very helpful to them, very informative, because I think a lot of the regulatory community had a perception that it's more like how business was done in the 1950s and 60s, not in, 2020.
What would the industry like to find under the Christmas tree?
Well, the thing is always we think is very attainable, and it's one of those things at Christmas that we would like to see come to fruition over this next year, is the policy, the U.S. policy with respect to gene editing and breeding methods as they evolve. We think there's great opportunity. A lot of work has been done in the public and private sector to better understand genetics of plants, and then how do you bring those genetics from, the discovery stage into the field. And so when you look at things like you've got a purple tomato that was, it's a GMO tomato, it's a fantastic product that's coming into the marketplace this year. We've got some others that are dealing with lettuces and blueberries and blackberries and raspberries and just a lot of exciting things happening, but we've got to have certainty in our programs to make in our policies with respect to gene editing and other breeding practices, so that all companies can bring products to market with whatever the policy is with respect to breeding. So that's probably our one big wish under the Christmas tree, if we had one. We really like a lot of the other things that we need to make sure are not forgotten. We have to have good policy, as we talked about, with respect to seed treatments and other tools for the farmer's toolbox there. But I would say that evolving breeding techniques need to be able to be adopted across all crops and not just our major field crops.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I've been to China many times in the past. I can't go now. They've disinvited me permanently. But from Hong Kong, China, Macau.
Recently at the Hudson Institute, Robert O'Brien, former National Security Advisor on China.
But the Chinese people are great people, and Chinese Americans play such an important role in our country and great immigrants. But unfortunately, they're governed by a regime that wants to change our way of life. And as Miles and I were talking before the speech today, they're relentless. They're across every sector. They're across every region of the world. Everybody, whether you're in the South Pacific or Europe or Africa, whatever your specialty is, China is at the top of your agenda because the Chinese are relentless in trying to change the way that we live our lives. They're trying to change our liberty, change our way of life, and change the way the world is organized. And that's dangerous. And so specifically today, I want to talk about competitiveness.
Grazing cattle is an important component to many producers' management strategy. K-State Sustainable Beef Grazing Specialist Logan Thompson discusses the environmental impact cattle grazing has. He says why the cattle's rumination process is important and the sources of emissions that contribute to greenhouse gases.
Agriculture has a climate impact where we produce greenhouse gas emissions. And in the beef cattle industry, you know, we're not any different than any other industry in that respect. And we produce emissions primarily in the form of methane, which is produced in the rumen of cattle, which is actually a really good process for us because we're able to take, you know, forages that we want to be able to consume and create a high quality and, you know, edible human product. And then we also have emissions from manure as well in the form of methane and nitrous oxide. Those are our two primary emission sources. And those cows that are out on pasture for the year, primarily, right, in different regions of the country, it is different. But they're out on pasture or on grazing crop residues for a year. That diet is lower quality and higher fiber than you would see in a confinement operation, right? And that is what drives emissions up.
Thompson explains how producers can have a win-win situation.
The really cool thing about methane emissions and the way I like to structure it is it's an energetic loss from the diet, right? So if we can keep more of that carbon that would be emitted as methane available for the animal for use, whether that's for lactation or growth in growing cattle, then we could improve performance and as a byproduct also reduce emissions. So it could be a win-win for our producers.
There are a few things that Thompson explains that can help reduce methane contributions from cattle.
Yeah, so one, obviously, I think is just maintaining plenty of nutrition on your cow-calf herd, right? So keeping your cows in good body composition, right? Keep them cycling back and weaning a calf every year for as long as possible. That longevity plays a big role. And then, you know, improving the forage base if you're utilizing, you know, alternative forages, planting forages that are really productive and high quality. That could help reduce methane, but also help sequester carbon into our soils. And then another thing, something that we're researching on, not yet here in Kansas, but in other regions of the U.S., is how does grazing management, specifically rotational grazing, influence emissions and soil carbon sequestration and overall soil health? And we're seeing trends as we move across the country that rotational grazing, in some respects, does reduce methane and, you know, improve soil health as well.
That was Kansas State University Sustainable Beef Grazing Specialist Logan Thompson with things producers can do to help reduce the environmental impact of grazing cattle. I'm Shelby Varner, and this has been Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, it has really stalled, and a lot of that falls in the lap of the Cuban president, Manuel Diaz-Canel.
Arkansas Representative Rick Crawford is a member of the House Ag Committee, talks about ag trade with Cuba.
I worked very hard, as you know, on this issue and really in good faith on my part I've kind of gone out on a limb for this because this wasn't an easy step among Republicans, although we were making progress. Where we lost traction is there were a couple of issues. One of them had to do with the Havana Syndrome attacks that took place in our embassy and the lack of response, the lack of good faith demonstrated by the Cubans on that. We got where we sort of got past that and I was continuing the effort. Then we saw where Díaz-Canel made the decision to double down on his support for Maduro in Venezuela. And that basically was a deal breaker for most of our conference, demonstrated that we really couldn't deal with someone who wants to continue to associate with someone like Maduro. So while I do believe that, you know, in principle, Cuba would be a great market for U.S. commodities, I still believe that. But we can't do it unilaterally, and there ought to be some give and take. And so far, what we've seen from the Cubans is only willingness to take and not to give. And so there are a number of issues where they have not yielded, and one of those was on their dual currency. But other issues had to do with human rights and free speech suppression and mistreatment of dissidents and a variety of other issues that they just have not been very forthcoming on. And so I still think that there's opportunity in Cuba, but it can't be a one-way street where we give everything and they don't make any changes at all.
Late last year, the administration finally getting around to naming a chief ag negotiator, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley.
The Finance Committee announced a hearing for Doug McKelp. He's the nominee to be chief ag negotiator at the USTR. The hearing is going to be on September the 7th. I expect this nominee will be voted out of committee favorably. I think he's well qualified. And most importantly, to speed it along, we badly need new leadership in this position. We still do not have a confirmation hearing for another very important trade position. Alex Taylor, an Iowan, has been nominated to lead the U.S. Department of Agriculture's trade mission under the title of Undersecretary for Trade. More than one in five jobs in Iowa depends on international trade. That isn't just agriculture trade, that'd be all trade. And of course, Iowa is a top exporter of soybeans, corn, and pork. Iowa farmers depend on trade, and I've had multiple conversations during my town halls with farmers who are concerned about the lack of aggressiveness in pursuing free trade agreements by this administration. 19 months into this administration is far too long for these key roles to not be filled, meaning the trade roles that I've talked about. These roles need to be filled so that they can advocate for Iowa farmers and our rural economy.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, it's a law that was enacted right at the end of 2017 that took effect beginning for tax years that started after 2017.
Roger McCohen is a tax law specialist at Washburn University.
And it runs through 2025. So that changed the tax law dramatically in a number of areas. And, of course, one of the things that many people are familiar with is that it substantially increased the federal estate tax and gift tax exemption from then $5 million and doubled it and then set it for inflation increases each year. And it's now just shy of $13 million per person to offset taxable estate at death as well as taxable gifts made during life. That will expire if Congress does nothing. That's just one of the things that will expire at the end of 2025, and that one goes back to $5 million with an inflation adjustment. It'll probably be about $7 million. So essentially, with two more inflation adjustments, one for 2024 and one for 2025, before it reverts back to the old law, it's basically going to be cut in half. And so many people are familiar with that, many farmers and ranchers in particular, and that raises some concerns from a planning standpoint, because if that exemption collapses to essentially become $7 million, then that's going to have an impact on a lot more farms and ranches than the current law does. And that's just one aspect of what will sunset if Congress does nothing.
But what about changes for homeowners?
For homeowners, the current limit on the mortgage interest deduction will be removed, and so that's a good thing for a lot of people that have high-value homes or have multiple homes and are not able to fully deduct the mortgage interest. Also, the 2017 law, TCJA, removed the penalty for not getting government health insurance, the mandate under Obamacare, the penalty that was associated with that. But that'll come back starting in 2026 if Congress does nothing. Some other things that are there, people in the lower income groups will see a substantial tax increase. For starters, those rates are going to go up. Currently, those people that are paying tax, federal tax, at a 12% rate are going to see a 25% increase in their tax rate. And the standard deduction is going to be cut back in half, basically. It's going to be reduced back to where it was prior to the 2017 law, because what that law did, what TCJA did, was double the standard deduction. Now, it eliminated a lot of itemized deductions, but many people don't itemize. But it doubled the standard deduction and took a lot of lower-income people completely off the tax rolls. Well, those people are going to come back on, and then those that are, for example, in the 12% rate under TCJA, if Congress does nothing, they're going to see, as I said, a 25% tax rate increase.
How can you navigate through uncertain times?
I'm concerned that Congress is, regardless of who's in political power at that time, in the executive branch or in the legislative branch, given the current situation in the world and economic issues, the level of the national debt, how difficult it will be to sustain and continue the existing tax scheme that we have. And I think we're probably in the most favorable tax environment that we could possibly be in, and it's only downhill from here. So with that said, what can we do? Well, it's very difficult to put a plan in when we don't know for sure what the future holds. But what we can do is be talking with our tax professionals and our planning professionals and being in touch with them to make sure that whatever plan we have in place is flexible enough to deal with any changes that might occur, deal with it in the best way that we possibly can. And that's the key, is really to kind of stay in tune, stay in touch with your professionals as to where your, what your plan is right now, what your tax situation is right now, what your estate plan is right now, and be able to adjust as quickly as you possibly can as soon as we know for sure what Congress might or might not do.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, I think overall, coming out of the several years of drought, there's definitely been some concern about just moving forward and making sure that we've got the appropriate risk management tools in place.
Chandler Gould is CEO, National Association of Wheat Growers.
Of course, we continue to work on the Farm Bill reauthorization. As you know, it expired on September 30th of this year. And really looking at how do we increase the farm bill so that the safety net is actually keeping up with cost of production. And when you look at when the bill was last reauthorized, from 2018 to 2023, cost of production has skyrocketed for multiple reasons. And we need to make sure that we have the best risk management tools and leverages in that bill so that our producers, have some certainty going forward. And we continue to work with both the House and Senate Agriculture Committees to get that bill fully reauthorized and updated for another 4 to 5 year term.
Congress has a funding issue to contend with.
Until the Congress can figure out how to fund itself for a longer term, I'm a little worried that the farm bill is going to continue to be pushed. We already know it's going to be pushed into next year. The question is, how far? Are we talking March, May, and then you get into the election cycle? So there's just a lot of variables floating around. But if we can't, first we've got to fund the government so we can truly focus on passing the farm bill.
On California's Prop 65.
Well, we had a huge win yesterday, not only for the U.S. wheat grower, but really for all commodities in agriculture. NOG has been the lead plaintiff against the state of California in regards to their Prop 65, which was going to require any product that had glyphosate applied to it to put a very misleading and false warning label on the food products or other end uses, wherever they may go. And NOG, along with a coalition, sued the state of California over the fact that we know glyphosate is safe. There has been numerous EPA, HHS, Institute of Health, the EU, which we know is so strict on so many of the crop protection chemicals, have all tested and said glyphosate is safe. And Prop 65 is going to force a misleading and false label on there. A permanent injunction was granted by the Ninth Circuit yesterday saying that California cannot require that warning label to be put on there because there was no scientific data that backed their claims. And so we have been fighting this for 6 years. This is an excellent win for us. It's an excellent precedent for agriculture. And we're just thrilled that the court actually made a science-based decision and not just on emotion.
And talks about EPA.
We actually just need to see, the EPA to make sure that through FIFRA, If EPA says a product is safe and it has gone through the registration process, then there is state preemption, and we cannot go around and have 50 states come back and add additional labeling or saying that, you know, they want X, Y, and Z to be done to a commodity or for a commodity before it can enter their state. And California is by far the worst. And it's not just crop protection. I mean, look what they did to eggs and what they're doing to pork. Between the Interstate Commerce Clause and preemption of the federal government, California seems to think of their own country up there, and they want to dictate to the rest of the country how we are going to produce food to feed everybody. And this is just a huge win for us, showing that our EPA and our regulatory agencies have said this product is safe, and therefore it is safe in all 50 states and to move forward. And we're hoping this will set a precedent, not only for commodities, but also on the livestock side, as things continue to, I would say, degrade in California. But this is still a huge win for us here at NOG and the U.S. Wheat Growers, and we look forward to continuing with our coalition on this and other issues facing our growers.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I basically have set up an outline that is the known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns of the science on soil carbon, based on our former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
Iowa State agronomist Marshall McDaniel.
The known known that we know is that conservation practices on average increase soil organic carbon. And that's based on hundreds and hundreds of individual studies that are aggregated into what are called meta-analyses. And we know on average practices like no-till, cover crops, and adding manure can increase soil carbon from 0.1 to greater than 1 megagram or a ton of carbon per hectare per year. Some of the unknown unknowns is that monitoring that change in soil organic carbon is very challenging due just to the inherent spatial variability or how variable it is within a farm field. Soil organic carbon changes very slowly. And then places like Iowa, where we have these very rich mollisols pictured here in the bottom right, the amount of organic carbon is already very high and can make monitoring changes very challenging. The other kind of known unknowns with the science on soil carbon is that there are co-benefits and trade-offs with these management practices that increase soil organic carbon. So co-benefits are other important agronomic or environmental benefits of these soil health practices that are not related to carbon, like maybe reducing nutrient leaching or improving water holding capacity, whereas trade-offs are things that are negative that also come along with some of these conservation practices that increase soil organic carbon, and that might be a decrease in yield. And some of the unknown unknowns are how is government involvement going to change, and that will really affect the how these carbon markets fluctuate and how we monitor and report and verify changes in soil carbon. And then another kind of unknown unknown is rapidly developing technologies to quickly measure soil organic carbon, and this could improve the challenge and the known unknown of monitoring soil organic carbon change.
Iowa State Extension Specialist Dan Anderson.
We're really talking about how does carbon, nitrogen, and energy move through my farm and my manure storage system. What we're trying to do with livestock production is take plant feedstuffs, convert it into meat, milk, and eggs, and have a tasty product. As part of that, we do generate some manure. That manure can have a substantial impact on our greenhouse gas footprint, especially how much methane and N2O we make. The choices we make in what our facility looks like and how we're treating that manure have a huge impact on how much methane we actually make. Here in Iowa, we have lots of choices for manure systems, ranging from a bedded pack solid manure system to deep pit liquid manure systems. What we tend to see is that those liquid systems make more methane, and because of that, we have opportunities to do things like solid liquid separation, covering those liquid storages that will alter how much methane and N2O we make, changing our greenhouse gas footprint. There are opportunities in the carbon market to sell those voluntarily to companies looking to improve their sustainability footprint, or work to get that as a fuel source supplied to gas pipelines throughout the state to collect RIN or LCFS credits. And this LCFS market has looked relatively lucrative for livestock farms and allowed us especially to think about what are some potential opportunities we have to improve our environmental footprint while also increasing our sustainability. the markets are still relatively early, relatively new, but there are lots of opportunities there.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Over the last few months for hog producers,
prices have been relatively soft.
So not a lot of incentive to boost pork production very much in 2024. This from USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Jekanowski. He thinks next year's pork output will be what he calls
relatively flat. I mean, up just a bit. Up about 500 million pounds year over year.
Or a little less than a 2% increase at 27.7 billion pounds. Now, as far as hog prices go for next year,
we're anticipating some growth.
But not as much as what was being forecast a month ago.
Just because we're not quite seeing the level of demand that we had anticipated.
So the new forecast for average hog prices next year?
$60.25 per hundredweight. That would be up about $1.30 per hundredweight year over year.
Or about a 2% increase from this year's average hog price. Gary Crawford, Washington.